Okay, we'll begin the meeting now.
Sorry. For committee members that aren't on Chair Paymar's committee, Melanie is filling in today for Patrick. So if you have questions of her. Just looking at the calendar, this looks like Representative Bigham Day for bills. First one we're going to take is the one on House File 1123. And it's, let's see. It's clarifying the authority of the Department of Public Safety to disclose driving record information to law enforcement agencies. And Representative Bigham, do you have what you can? Do you have witnesses on this, or Mr. just you gonna?
Mr. Chair, yeah, we do have witnesses. And
okay.
We have a comment from the.
Oh, she can move the bill. Representative Bigham, let's see. First, you move the bill, and you don't have any amendments, is my understanding.
Mr. Chair, no, I do not have any.
Okay.
Amendments to House File 1123, which I now move.
Okay, and Representative Bigham, would you go ahead and present your bill?
I have Pat McCormick here from the Department of Vehicle Services, and right now, local county sheriffs, city attorneys, and county prosecutors obtain driving records, just your driving record. Information already, and this just puts into compliance that procedure, and I can let Pat McCormick talk about that.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Just for the record, my name's Pat McCormick. I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services, and as Representative Bigham said, the federal law, one of the permissible uses is for us to allow driver data to be given to law enforcement when it's being used in terms of investigation or any type of law enforcement or public safety activities. But in terms of trying to ensure that we have explicit authority in the statutes, Driver and Vehicle Services is requesting this change so that specifically it's in our driver license statutes in Chapter 171 that we can give law enforcement driver license data.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the author or the witness on this? Pretty straightforward bill.
Yes.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Then we will take, I screwed up again. This has got no fiscal implications. I took the wrong, we weren't supposed to vote. Chair screwed up. The chair is laying it over for inclusion in the omnibus crime bill coming out of here, the non-fiscal one. Apologize. lucky staff caught that. Representative Bigham, the next one is the checking the sex offender registry at booking House File 1118. And would you move the bill first?
Mr. Chair, I do move House File 1118.
And I assume that's your witness. Do you want to go ahead and present your bill?
If this bill is brought, as the previous bill was brought by the Department of Public Safety, and this is asking, Mr. Chair, I forgot, I do have an amendment to this one.
Is it in our packet, or?
I think it was passed out, so I apologize. I will move Amendment A7, which on page 1, line 21, would insert intentionally. After who would insert intentionally.
Okay. Representative Bingham moves A070103 amendment to get it in the shape that she wants it in to present to the committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Okay. Representative Bingham, go ahead and explain your bill with and the effect of the amendment.
Okay. This requires jails, workhouses, and juvenile detention centers to check the predator offender registration at the time of intake booking. What this allows is to get a current address and location if a positive if somebody would come up in it as they're being arrested, which we would hope not, but if they come up, then we would be able to obtain current address and information on them. The local institutions already have access to this database. There's no fiscal implications to this database. And the reason for the amendment is kind of when the department brought it to me, I just didn't want sheriffs to get in trouble unless it was intentionally that they did this, which was that amendment was offered by the department as well. So I can.
Okay, and your witness, your name?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Anne Marie O'Neill. I'm a supervisor in the Predatory Offender Registration Unit at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And we bring this to you primarily because we're interested in helping us get non-compliant offenders back into compliance. What's happening is our non-compliant registrants are being arrested for other offenses such as DWI or burglary or some other offense, and they're getting booked into the jails, and that's an opportunity to get the person into compliance, especially if they're not currently under supervision by the Department of Corrections. And that opportunity is often being lost because the jails are not doing a check of the predatory offender registration database.
Okay. Are there again, it's pretty straightforward. Are there any questions or comments by anybody on the committee? Okay, then, Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, I would just ask that this be laid over for consideration. It's an omnibus bill.
That's what I was just going to do. Thank you for helping keep me from making the mistake again. okay, that is done. Your next bill is House File 867, and I have two amendments to that bill. Are there any others that anybody knows of? One is the A2 amendment, and one is an A3 amendment from Representative Emmer, I believe. No.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bigham?
I will move both of these amendments at separate times, but the first one to Amendment A2.
Okay, Representative Bigham, first, then move your bill, then, if you're going to do these as authors.
And move House File 867.
Okay, and then go ahead. Then that's before us. Do you want to move your amendments then?
Yep.
One by one.
First to Amendment A2. This amendment...
just move it to get it before you talk about it. So just... You want to place this before the committee, and that's...
Yeah, I was just going to... Mr. Chair, I was just going to speak to both amendments separately.
Right. We have to get it into
okay,
the...
I'll
want to get the bill in the shape that you want to talk about it. So we have to take A2 amendments, which you've just moved, and then since usually we accept that, but everybody votes for it. So all in favor of putting the bill, the A2 amendment on the bill to help get it in the author's version, vote, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Okay, and then you want to move your next amendment?
And then I would move the A3 amendment.
Okay, and once again, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Okay, now the bill is in the shape that you want it in.
So. I'll speak to the two amendments just out of for curiosity. Is the first one defines, kind of broadens the school building definition. Second one, in the spirit of making a good bill better, Representative Erdahl asked that we include historic property, and I could talk a little bit about that after during the bill here. In June of last year, Oatman Junior High in St. Paul Park, Minnesota, was burglarized and had over $200,000 worth of damage. There has been incidences in most of our districts, but in this state, where city halls churches. One of the more notable ones, religious buildings. One of the more notable ones was the Hindu temple in Representative Pepin's district out in Maple Grove. And there's been a few instances of City Hall. Cottage Grove had a burglary in their City Hall. And currently, as the law reads, that would be a third-degree burglary. And what this does is it makes it a second-degree burglary if you have the intent to enter a religious building, government center, or government building, or school building with the intent to commit criminal damage to property or theft. And I have two witnesses here to talk about the Oltman Junior High incident in my district, Assistant Principal Todd Herber and Assistant Washington County Attorney Tony
Stroik, Z-D-R-O-I-K.
And they, Tony will be here to stand for questions and talk a little bit about has a couple comments about the bill, and Mr. Herber will talk about how it affected the community, the students, and faculty. Mr. Herber.
Thank you.
Mr. Herber.
Thank you for having me testify today. This is very important for our community. Back in June, our building received a great deal of damage due to the result of a couple of students coming in after school had concluded for the year. And while our building was being cleaned, they broke a window, entered into the art room, of all places, where they procured lots of paints and other materials and made a large mess. They targeted one of our teachers specifically, used defiling names, scrawled all over her classroom, desks, pools of paint in our kiln for crafts, brand new computer technology, which we had just put in April. The machines were only a couple months old, that were destroyed as a result of paints. The students also went about the building with fire extinguishers and let them off, which as a result of that, the residue destroys electronics. It's corrosive, so all the affected equipment had to be replaced. Many, like I said, new computers, televisions, DVD players, VCRs, radios, overhead projectors. Also, the ventilation system had to be cleaned because some of that residue made its way into the ventilation system, which really skyrocketed the price of the damages to our school. The people that were greatly affected, it was just fascinating. Within 2 days, I had parents calling, kids calling, saying, can we come down and help clean up? This is our school. Oltman has been in the St. Paul Park community for over 50 years, and it's part of that community's identity. And many of our parents are alumni of Oltman Junior High. Many of our teachers are alumni of Oltman Junior High. And we're devastated to hear what had happened to our school. They were shocked at who the students were who did it. But perhaps most moving for me personally was my principal, John Holm, who had just retired, was in his final couple weeks finishing up his duties and responsibilities prior to retirement, ended up having to deal with a large mess. And it was very frustrating. It caused a great deal of pain for the teacher that was targeted. It was a very hard time for her as well. But I do have to say it was... The silver lining is the number of people that came out from our community to support our school who volunteered to come down and help get our school back in order before the start of the school year to begin.
Thank you. Mr. Stroik?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm the Juvenile Division Chief in the Washington County Attorney's Office, and my office actually prosecuted the case involving the Oltman Junior High incident. And... we did, under the law at the time, charge the individuals involved with burglary in the third degree and criminal damage to property. But one of the problems we saw with that is it didn't really equate the type of charge with the seriousness of that type of offense. If you look at how the burglary statute is set up, essentially any burglary of any building where theft is committed is a burglary in the third degree. And along the same lines of how Mr. Herber just testified, there's a difference when you have any building as opposed to schools, as opposed to churches and government buildings as well. people consider that more of a safer place, a place that they want to be safe, a place that they take pride in. Under the past state of the law, the type of burglary that occurred in this case would be charged the same as a burglary of a storage shed where a couple of tools were stolen. Representative Biggins' bill really more equates the type of conduct in Mr. Herbert's case and the type of conduct that actually we see on a semi-regular basis with similar burglaries to this with how serious the actual offense is. That's why I support Representative Biggins' bill. I can indicate that this isn't an isolated incident. In reviewing files just off the top of my head from this year, schools are targeted. We had Valley Crossing Elementary School in Woodbury where there were 40 windows broken out by juveniles this year. We also had a storage shed down in Cottage Grove that was set ablaze by some juveniles this year. And I thought a few years ago when I was doing felony prosecutions for adults, we had some just graduated 18-year-old adults who essentially trashed in the same manner that Mr. Herbert talked about the Tartan High School in Oakdale, spreading popcorn oil throughout the school and throwing popcorn in it and again spray painting at him. So I think there's a really good, there's a need for this bill out there to stress the seriousness of this type of conduct. I would also add, if you look at the burglary in the second degree statute, other buildings have been recognized in a similar matter. Currently, banks are covered under burglary in the second degree in certain circumstances, as well as pharmacies. So I think it would be a helpful bill. It would be a bill that both in juvenile law that I prosecuted and in adult felonies I prosecuted, it would be something that we would consider.
Thank you. Yes, the first one I remember that was really bad was the West St. Paul one many years ago. Representative Coles?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure who this question is for. I'm looking at the bill, and I support it. I think I might be a co-author on it. But my question is, has a fiscal note been requested? Does one need to be requested? I see that we're enhancing a sentence here, so I don't know if one's been requested or not, and if this is going to be laid over, if it's going to go to Representative Coles.
Representative Coles, this will be laid over, so that will be taken care of in the meantime.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Bigham. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to make a couple additional comments. In my day job at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, where I am part of an adult prosecution property crimes team, we've had a few cases with adults that this has been, this has occurred. And, you know, these three areas hit at the heart of a community. When your home is violated, burglarized, you feel violated and not safe. So when you go to school or go to a religious building, you know, you ought to be feeling safe there too and be able to concentrate and do what you're there to do. And I urge support of this bill, and I thank majority of this committee for signing on to the bill. And I do ask for your consideration and would be willing to answer any questions that the members would have.
Representative Pimar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, did you request a fiscal note on House File 867?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pimar, I did, and I was just informed about a couple minutes before the committee started that there is a, it's not complete, but looks like there is a bed implication. So I would ask in this circumstance that it be referred to public safety finance so that we could have a further discussion once the note is complete.
Well, Representative Bingham, it was my understanding we were going to lay it over and then get the note, and then if we need to, then it would be referred to Representative Paytonar's committee. Representative Immer, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bigham, I might have missed it as we started because I was running back and forth, but did we, did you offer the A, what is it, the A3? Is that one of the ones that you were moving? So we're all taken care of. You offered that.
Representative Emmer,
right.
She offered both of those as author's amendments so that
Representative Emmer that was in the spirit of making a good feel better.
Is there any... Oh, Representative Kranz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Bingham, is there... I would assume that in putting this in place that there is some form of... I want to call it an educational system to inform school children or other people in the community that, because I think making the penalty stiffer is not necessarily going to be an effective deterrent unless the kids really understand it and people in our community. So it doesn't have to be in the bill, but maybe you can just help me out as far as how the community is going to know that this is a stiffer penalty.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bingham.
Representative Kranz, if you'd want to talk a little bit about that. But the one comment I would say is there is judicial and prosecutorial discretion, and I can let the county assistant county attorney.
You know, in looking at the bill, it does enhance the maximum penalty from a $10,000 maximum penalty to a $10,000-$20,000 maximum penalty. And one of the things that's going to have to eventually be decided is by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, are they going to categorize that under what severity level type of offense? So in terms of whether there's going to be a more severe penalty or not, I think that's going to have to be something looked at by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission and so forth. Having dealt with juvenile law for about 8 years, we have plenty of discussions. We go to a lot of schools to talk about a lot of different issues. I see that maybe, I don't know if you want to call it grassroots approach, but we do go to a lot of schools, at least in Washington County, to talk about some of the issues that we face in court and in charging every day. So that could be an approach that was taken. In my conversations with Representative Biggin, I haven't off the top of my head figured out a way maybe to spread the word regarding that. But I think it's something that can be implemented just simply through word of mouth through, at least in Washington County, with the discussions we have with students. We have twice a month we meet with students and tell them how they shouldn't be skipping school. So it could be something as simple as that. So, and we do have the big case referred to by Mr. Herbert as kind of a point of reference. So I think it's something that could occur.
Representative Kranz.
Just to follow up, I just wanted to add that out there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as something that I'm not sure and convinced as a high school teacher that just stiffening a penalty or enabling you to prosecute on a greater scale is going to necessarily deter people unless they know what's going on. So I just wanted to, on the record here, say that I would hope that there's some educational component to this as we move forward.
Well,
thank you.
Representative France, I hope you'll vote for my bill on that and introduced. Which was recommended to me that there be schooling in that from the Minneapolis Police Department. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Chairman. Just a couple quick comments. One comment was that as in my former life as Payne County Attorney, I had the honor of handling a Franklin Middle School, which would be about the same age group, burglary, with a lot of criminal damage to property done, and a couple of violas, which are not cheap, stolen that belong to the school. So I'm 100% behind the bill in that respect. Second, I'd like to thank Representative Emmers for his amendment because I happen to agree with that amendment from the Historic Society.
Mr. Chair, I promised Representative Erdahl I would talk about that. He has a church in his district that is no longer used for holding services, but has been converted to a historical site. And I believe, I don't know the details, but he told me that it was vandalized and just substantial damage. And so he asked that we include this definition in. And so that's the explanation of Representative Emmer and Erdahl's amendment.
Okay, if there's no further discussion, then I think everybody's ready to vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carries. Next. Oh.
Thank you for participating in.
No. What am I doing? This is bad. Two out of three times I've been wrong. So the bill is laid over for possible inclusion unless we find out that there's a fiscal note that it needs to go to. Then we'll bring it up and just send it down.
Mr. Chair, I'll just.
Mr. Chair, I just note that you have the consent of the committee that very clearly to lay it over.
Thank you. Participating in Representative Bigham Day in the committee.
Thank you, Representative Bigham. Representative Kalin, since you were the last one to talk, you moved the minutes of the February 20th meeting. Is there any discussion? Okay, all in favor say aye. All opposed? Carries 1-0. Thank you, Representative Filstrom. Somebody's awake. Boy, that's powerful. One vote you carried. The next bill up is Representative Lesch, House File 49. And this is another bill that will be up for possible inclusion in the omnibus crime non-fiscal bill for the committee. And Representative Lesch, do you have a, do you want, I think you've got a short CD or something, do you want, first we'll have to have the bill moved and.
It's set up right now, if that's okay.
Just a second.
Desperate.
No, you don't. Oh. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cole.
Do you know, has a fiscal note been requested on this bill? I know that I understand what you're intending to lay it over, but I mean, as I read through it here while Representative Lesch is getting ready,
I don't know.
You're on mute, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Oops. I don't think there's. My understanding was we're going to look into it, but I didn't think initially that there was a state implication, but there would be local implications.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess as I look at Section 4, I think there might be a cost to the courts. I'm fine. I don't have a problem with laying it over to wait and see if we get a fiscal or not. I guess that's between you and Chairman Tamar.
Representative Coles will take care of that issue before we get to the omnibus bill for sure. And often the courts one, the little difference, they just don't count as a fiscal. Representative Lesch, are you ready to start your presentation?
Yes,
move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I would move House File 49 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, which I believe is correct motion. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I do have some testifiers, and so if the testifiers can come up here now, and also I have a short clip to show if that's okay with the Chair.
Representative Lesch, do you know how long your testifiers will be? I'm just trying to space out. We need some discussion time at the end. We need some opponents.
Yeah, but
I believe the realtor, or not the realtors, the landlords.
Multi-housing did want to come up and say something briefly as well, Mr. Chair. I have been speaking with them about the bill as well. So I think we're okay. When do we end again? I can't remember.
Have you been on this?
I think we'll be trying to play in time, Mr. Chair. We'll go over, okay? But if... before I begin, Mr. Chair, I did want to speak to a couple of things to the bill, and also in the House research summary, which some people I think were confused about in terms of the burden and the standard of proof in Section 7. It does state, and of course I'm going to need a copy of the bill, it speaks of, in Section 7, proof that a place is frequently used for engaging in gang activity by a member of a criminal gang is prima facie evidence that the person who owns or is responsible for maintaining the place knowingly permitted the act. I just wanted to clarify because it does speak to burden shifting, but what this is specifically, it states that the case is appropriate to be before a trier of fact. not necessarily that the burden is shifted prior to the time that a case is even filed. So I wanted to clarify that. It's specifically designed so that the individuals are able to get their facts of their case heard before a neutral trier of fact. So I wanted to clarify that first off.
So just let me clarify that. So this doesn't get into the issue of the burden shifting not being valid in criminal law. You're a prosecutor. You probably, well, there's a couple of you here. That you don't run into that issue in this
Once case. In a while we do, Mr. Chair.
I mean in this bill, then.
Okay, can you restate the question? I'm sorry.
Okay, we have to be careful on the criminal bills that we don't have a bill where we are basically making a certain activity a crime and then they have to
Correct.
Prove that they weren't doing that. As in civil law, you can do that. In criminal, we have to be careful not to. And I guess staff would also. There's no problem with that, then you're saying.
With what?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
We're okay because it's civil.
Then, yes, Mr. Chair.
Even if we were doing that, which we're not.
Which you're not. Okay, well, since it's civil law, obviously.
I did want
to only remedy a civil law. Go ahead, Representative.
I did want to introduce Minneapolis Councilmember Gary Schiff, and actually he has a testifier here as well. But before we begin, I do have a short clip if I could show that. I think we may have some technical issues with this, but if it's okay, I'm just going to start that, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Can you see it on the screens?
I got no sound. She said the sound is off on the computer and the other sound.
No.
Okay. We're in an effort to protect the neighborhood. Tonight we ride along with police to see how a gang injunction on the city's west side is working out. Tonight's big news.
It's a legal move to take drugs off the streets in a west side neighborhood, but is a new gang injunction making a difference for the folks who live in the Lincoln courts? The 19th Gina Galavis on patrol with the men and women in blue as they enforce that ban. This one, the case has long exclusive.
The Lincoln courts, where kings once ruled, drug dealing and other illegal activity, police say, was their kingdom.
There's an injunction out here, so we're checking everybody.
The injunction, now 3 weeks old, keeps certain gang members from associating together, from hanging out at street corners, specifically this food store on Hamilton and Albert Streets. Antoine Clark admits he is in the targeted gang.
The first day we broadcast on TV, it was like a ghost town, right? It was like some of you coming through here.
There are 17 known gang members on that gang injunction list. That's why the SAPD gang unit is driving around looking for them, making sure they're all obeying the order.
19-year-old Steve Alvarado is on that list.
No matter, they're the same, they don't change.
Alvarado is alone when Sergeant Michael Leva and Officer Ralph Medell stop him. He is not violating the injunction.
Can't even talk to you like your friends, right? Has that been kind of tough?
SAPD has arrested 3 of Alvarado's associates, all caught violating the injunction.
This is kind of a lot better. We're not going to shoot you on this long
time.
It's been a while.
Well, go up forward, you know what I'm saying, please come out at night.
The injunction simply makes Lincoln Court's neighborhood a safety zone. Constant police patrols aim to keep it drug and crime free.
They say they're going to, crack down on us being out here and chilling in the hood. So this is what we're pouring away, that you know what I'm saying?
Gina Galavis, KSAT 12 News.
Anyway, Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you,
Representative
Schiff would like to testify.
Councilmember Schiff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members, for your time this afternoon. I'm also here with Bill Ziegler, the Executive Director of Little Earth, United Tribes of Little Earth, which is a housing complex in Ward 9. I represent Ward 9. My constituents are very diverse. 1 out of 3 of the people I represent are under the age of 18. And in looking at the violent crime statistics in the city of Minneapolis, growing youth crime and youth gangs is the number one reason why crime is on the rise in the city of Minneapolis. The number of gangs that operate in my ward make my neighborhood the highest concentration and has the most diverse number of gangs. It includes gangs like Serenios, Vatos Locos, the Latin Kings, the Rolling Twenties, the Doughboys, the Family Mob, the Native Mob, the Gangster Disciples, Somali Hot Boys, Somali Outlaws, and the Vice Lords. 11 gangs operating in just 5 neighborhoods for competition of our youth. Recruiting new youth is the number one tool that these gangs have to grow in size and power. And this bill offers the best opportunity we have to protect youth from gang members and to keep gang members out of the areas where they want to go after new membership. This property, a rental property, just across the street from Anishinaabe Academy in my district, it's covered with gang graffiti, as you can see, from the Serenios. They target buildings across the street from public schools in order to send messages to those kids as they're leaving school every day. But thank you very much. This bill will give us one more tool to be able to say for gang members who are going through parks, through our public schools, and are going to places like convenience stores, like the Somali convenience store and the Somali Mall that's owned in my district, near 24th and 10th Avenue South. We've had several shootings, and last year, the first gang-related homicide, just one block from that property. We know where gangs hang out. We know who their target populations are. This bill gives us a powerful new tool to be able to stop that gang recruitment so that we can protect our kids. And I ask for your full support today.
Mr. Ziegler?
Thank you for having me. I'm going to tell you just real briefly a story, which is not uncommon. We have a young man at Little Earth by the name of Josh. For 4 years, he's been trying to resist the influence of gangs in our community. He's had older brothers getting mixed up in it, killed, sent to prison. For 4 years, since this boy was 9 years old, he's been telling gangs no. He has been shot. He's been stabbed. Last summer, he was run over by a car when he was sitting on a park bench in the park. His only crime was to tell the gangs, no, I'm not interested. His only crime is really growing up and living in a community that's an impoverished community, and his folks don't have money. You know, in many cases in our community, the kids don't have the support that they need at home to really give them the strength to resist the gangs. As an organization, we have tried and we're doing our best to combat the gangs. We have youth development programs, we have mentoring programs, we're putting all the things in place that we can to try to give these kids another choice in life. But frankly, we can't be in the community 24 hours a day to monitor this. We need help is what it comes down to. I think that a 9, 10-year-old kid having to make a life or death decision at that age on whether to join a gang or to try to go to school, that's a big burden for a child that young to have to carry. And it's common is a problem. And you know, Josh, the story is not unique in our community. Every kid in our community is faced with having to make that decision. I got my son's 8 now. When he was 7 years old, I sent him back home to South Dakota because he was already being recruited by gangs. 7 years old. He's a big kid. But 7 years old, he was being recruited by gangs, so I shipped him back to South Dakota so he didn't have to deal with that. There's a lot of things that communities can do, and we're doing all we can. But frankly, without the other side of the coin, without having the support of the law on our side to actually make these things criminal acts, we're going to continue to tread water here. Thank you.
Just one question, Mr. Ziegler. Are you the one at Little Earth?
Yeah.
Here. Okay. Okay. I just wanted to say I've heard a lot of good work from you since you've been there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lush, do you have...
Thank you. Just could I ask Mr. Ziegler describe a little bit more for members of the committee who don't know what Little Earth is? Could you describe what it is?
Little Earth of United Tribes is actually really unique. It is the only Indian preference housing community in the nation. It's 100% Section 8. The only place that you'll find a Little Earth is on reservations, you know, where there is Indian preference in housing. We have that at Little Earth, where we have Indian preference on housing. Our community is made up of 38 different tribal nations that are represented at Little Earth. from tribes from all across the nation. Primarily it is Anishinaabe and Dakota, but there's Indian folks from all over that moved to Little Earth, and it is really, I think, the center of the Native American community in the metro area. It's readily identified as such, and that's how everybody sees it, as the center of the Native American community. And one thing I tend to tell people is, as Little Earth goes, so goes the larger Indian community. So when we have issues in our community, when we have violence and what have you, that affects the entire Native American community in the metro area. I am happy to report that we have not had a gang shooting at Little Earth in 20 months. We have taken a hard line against gangs and gang activity, and things are better than they were 2 years ago when I got to Little Earth. But we could always do more, and I'm always looking at what more can I be doing to make my community safer. This obviously would be one more thing that can be done to make life better for the people and make it so a 9-year-old boy doesn't have to make that decision in life on should I join the gangs or should I try to stay in school. Thank you.
Are there any questions of these two witnesses? Representative Lush, do you have any other?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few more witnesses, and before I went to those other witnesses shortly, I'm going to call up Jim Harmo, who's Assistant Commander of the Metro Gang Strike Force, Captain Mike Martin of Minneapolis Police Department, and Rich Strock of the St. Paul Police Department. But before I do that, I wanted to speak a little bit to the bill and what it does.
Representative Lush, can you, I'm not sure, I want to reserve time because I know there's going to be discussion about some issues. And how many could the people, I know that the Multi-Housing Association is going to speak on this. Is there anybody else in the room who wants to speak on this other than Multi-Housing or the ones that Representative Lush mentioned? Okay, Representative Lush, could you try to get them within about 6-7 minutes?
Yes. Maybe? Yeah, I'll get shorter than that, Mr. Chair. Thank you. For those of you familiar with crime, difference between civil and criminal law in the state of Minnesota, I'll describe this to you a little bit in the way I would describe a domestic violence situation. In situations where you have domestic violence, oftentimes the police can prove cases against domestic abusers, and we're able to convict an individual, put them in jail, put them on probation, and get conditions of probation on them. Those probations can include a probation no contact order. They can include other types of requirements to ensure that a person stays in compliance and doesn't reoffend over the course of the period of probation. In some cases, though, for whatever reason, a victim, we don't have a victim, or we don't prosecute the domestic assault, and all we have is what is called an order for protection. When a victim goes into civil court and files for an order for protection against an abuser, in that case, a victim signs an affidavit alleging a number of criteria that would cause a judge to say, yes, we think it's adequate to keep your abuser away from you, and in fact, it's a violation of a court order for that individual to come around and, you know, beat you up or even call you again. This gang injunction is similar to that civil order for protection. Violation of it is also a crime in itself, similar to violation of an order for protection. But in this case, it requires a certain proof standard that we have to show. In the case of domestic violence, you have to allege in an affidavit a number of things that have occurred that would warrant a judge to say, we're going to preclude a person from seeing you in the interest of your safety and public safety. Similarly, if you think in this case of the victim being a community or a specific community in which a particular gang operates. And so I'm thinking of up in my neighborhood, we've had some problems up in the area of Rice and Front. There's some areas down around Railroad Island where different gangs operate. If you think right down University near Aurora, just behind my village, if those of you frequented my village, there was some previous activities from Serenos 13. And those are the kinds of areas where we want to allow a neighborhood or a city or a county to come in and say, you as a gang member are precluded from associating with other gang members in that area. The idea is that we can't just put these people in jail because they get out of jail or sometimes they beat the rap. But we've got to put them out of business as well. And a gang member's turf is his business. He's able to operate and do what he wants to do in that way. You get him out of their element,
it makes it much more difficult for them to operate. Now, you could say, well, maybe they moved to another part of the city. Yeah, but they're still out of their element. It's more difficult for them to do that. Now, what this says is that if there are five incidents in a period of not more than 12 months where a gang operates with gang activity, which is defined in subdivision 4 of the definition section, that we can bring suit and preclude this person by whatever remedy the court deems adequate, and we're looking for an injunction in this case. Violation of that is also is contempt of court, but it sets out a specific remedy here in the statute as well, that a person is subject to a fine of not less than $1,000 nor more than $10,000 and confinement in jail for a term of not less than 10 days nor more than 30 days, or both a fine and confinement. Now, in a case of a violation of an order of protection, that's actually an enhanceable offense. It goes from misdemeanor to gross misdemeanor to felony upon repeated violations. We don't have that provision in this law, but it's similar in other respects. I believe that... one other thing that I would add also, and this may be touched on by when multi-housing comes up and testify, but I would point out that it's still the burden of the state to prove these facts in court, that in fact this is a gang member who is engaged in gang activity in a particular area, and the health and safety of that particular area is paramount and trumps any rights of the gang member to associate with other gang members in that area. Now, in proving that case, you can prove that the gang member has notice and he knows what he's doing, so he does it. In another case, you would have to show that, for example, the owner of a mini mart or a gas station has knowledge and specifically allowed this to continue. So other people may have concerns about that, but I can say in front of a trier of fact, that is going to be much, much more difficult to prove. Because we're not going to, unless the owner of the establishment is a gang member, you have to show to a trier of fact that absolutely they're encouraging and allowing this activity. It's much, much harder to prove, and we think that provides a sufficient remedy and should placate any concerns. So with that, Mr. Chair, and trying to be as brief as possible, I would call up the officers, police officers that I noted earlier, and anyone else who's here to testify with them, if they can come up here and testify.
Les, could you get them? I know Representative Martin and his great work, and I've heard of Stocka. I'm wondering. I'm just worried about. I know there's going to be some discussion at the end, and I'm worried
about. Maybe if they could come up and just make a brief statement.
Okay, if they could come up, because could you? Can you wait till...
Mr. Chair, I have a question, but I don't know at what point you want us
to... Is it of Representative Lash?
Yes.
Well, I think, why don't we get the testimony in, and then there'll be... I know there's others want to discuss the bill.
And we appreciate having time to ask questions on the bill.
Detective Martin? I'm not sure if you're a lieutenant now or what you're...
I'm not sure either. Mr. Chair and committee members, thanks for having me today. I'm Captain Mike Martin from the Minneapolis Police Department. I'm the commander.
I apologize.
Sorry. I've been called worse. I'm the commander of the Special Operations Division, which includes the Minneapolis officers that are assigned to the Minnesota Metro Gang Strike Force. Prior to that, I was the Metro Commander for the Minnesota Gang Strike Force for a couple years, and I've been working gang investigations for 12 years. I'm also the president of the Minnesota chapter of the Midwest Gang Investigators Association, which is the largest gang investigators association in the country. And here in Minnesota, we have 260 members who are gang investigators, and in the Midwest, we have 1,200 members. I strongly support this bill. I think that it'll provide us with a tool that we can use, but it also is balanced with the fact that we have to prove that it's a criminal gang that's involved, the fact that we have to show a continuing pattern of criminal activity. But I think that in my work in Minneapolis, this is a tool that I see that we can use to target specific locations or gangs that are causing us problems and leading to violence. And a lot of times it's not just the criminal activity that's occurring at that place, but the fact that it also allows rival gang members to find them because they know where they hang out. And that greatly affects the livability of the neighborhood. So thanks for having me, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions.
Is there going to be different testimony from... I'll call him Chief Straka so I don't underestimate the time. I'm getting very worried about getting enough time for multi-housing and for the issues and questions. So if there's nothing new, I'd like to move on and take the other testimony. Is that okay, Representative?
Okay. I would just note that Jim Heimerl, Assistant Commander of the Metro Gang Strike Force, is here in the front row as well, who supports the measure. And I have heard from many other law enforcement agencies in Minnesota who are very supportive of the language.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Horner, are you...
I would state, Mr. Chair, also, while multi-housing comes up here, I have spoken with Mr. Horner about this. He offered or was going to offer an amendment, and I had just seen that language for the first time about 20 minutes ago, and I thought that I told Mr. Horner this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, so I told him we could work with them on the notice time period. They wanted 60-day notice provision on top of notice for the suit. I told him we could talk about that. I did have some questions about the affirmative defense portion, subdivision D, that I wanted to think about a little bit more, but I told him we would talk further prior to the time this goes in the omnibus bill.
Okay. You're not Mr. Horner.
No, I'm not. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Todd Liljenquist. I am with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. First, I'd like to say we appreciate the concept of this bill. Obviously, we are very interested in criminal gang activity and would like criminal gang activity curtailed. We're not opposed to the large bulk of this bill. It does raise a couple issues that maybe haven't been addressed already, but I'd like to note that the bill does provide, in injunctive relief, does provide a great deal of power to the courts. One of the remedies available to the courts would be to close the property for a period of time. There's another already existing law which would provide for a year closure for property for public nuisances, such as gambling, prostitution, illegal substances. So that's the first point I'd like to make. And second, that this bill applies to all types of property, including rental housing, which obviously we're interested in, but business properties as well as homeowners. So as Representative Lesh already mentioned, the notice requirement is something that we are interested in. Notice and an opportunity to abate the nuisance that is already occurring. Representative Lesh has expressed some interest in working with us, and we're more than happy to reach some sort of consensus.
And I think you've also discussed your issues with Representative Immer, too, I believe.
That's correct.
If possible, I'd like to move on to the questions and the discussion. Representative Fulberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative West, a couple questions. When these five or more incidents occur, will the property owner be notified?
Well, Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, first of all, these are all items along that list of offenses listed in 60911. Those are items where there are, arrest pickups, that kinds of thing that are occurring at the property. I mean, if there are squad cars coming to your property day in and day out, we're presuming that you're going to, or we hope you know about it. The property owner should have reasonable notice if there are squads coming to their building tonight.
What I'm looking for is reasonable notice, and because I own a property doesn't mean that I reside there or I'm there frequently and would be there at midnight or 1 in the morning when some of these things may take place. What I'm trying to figure out here is for the property owner, who I'm assuming in some instances may be terribly intimidated by the activity that's occurring in their area and in fact may be afraid, similar to a domestic violence situation, that to turn these people in or to participate with law enforcement would have serious negative consequences. Number one, how do we reasonably let them know of these five or more instances so there's a problem? And how do we ascertain the responsibility. I mean, it's, I'm sure in some instances with these mini marts, these guys are in on it and, you know, they're part of the group, but I would hope in some instances they're just a business owner trying to make a living and aren't as happy about the behavior, and that's the property owner that I'm worried about in your bill, and that how do we know they won't just get dragged in and be deemed part of the problem as opposed to a victim of the same group of people?
Representative Locke. Thank you, and Mr. Chair, Representative Holwood. First of all, when I first heard that multi-housing was interested in this, I was a little bit surprised, and later I understood why. But when I first envisioned this, as you saw in the, I don't know if this clip showed, it might have been another clip, where they drew lines in the neighborhood around certain block areas. So with certain block areas, secondarily where I see gang activity in St. Paul, it's the mini marts, the gas stations, the places of congregation like that. Now, in terms of the housing, you know, it made me think of the movie New Jack City, where they turn an entire apartment complex and kind of this industry of gang and crime activity. And then I can see how, you know, to some extent, and you got a situation where, yeah, an owner is intimidated. Let there be no mistake, the city, the government, does not have more power than, say, a property owner to abate this kind of nuisance. And we would want to work with property owners, and I think the police department could affirm that as well. We want to work with property owners well before we were ever to get to this point. Now, the notice as provided, we would still have to prove this is going on. The notice as provided is when you name someone in the suit, that you receive notice for the suit. And if, in fact, there is no more problem, or someone says, wow, you know, I had 5 incidents in a year, and I had no idea about it because I just happened to be gone each one of those times and no one ever told me about it, maybe I don't come around that much and my property manager that I pay isn't telling me like he's supposed to. This is almost a wag the dog situation. I can't imagine we would be going after a person like that. It's in a very different type of situation. A property owner is going to know well in advance about all these calls because there is probably other type of licensing action being taken by the city prior to that.
Mr. Chair, your bill doesn't provide for that. You know, you have one perspective on how this might work, but the authority that you're giving here is pretty heavy-handed for the bad actors, and there's virtually no protection for the victims. And these crimes that you list are going to be, the tickets and stuff are going to be given to individuals, not to the property owner, and it's very conceivable. I might not be aware of the 5 strikes and you're in trouble provision. I just think that you're setting up people that could be your allies in this situation, and they can be blindsided because they may not be aware of this provision. And certainly Minneapolis and St. Paul have lots of community programs and community policing, and you talk about licensure, that somebody would, you know, send them a letter if they had so many violations, but that's not the case in all of our cities. And words matter, and we have no protections in here for those property owners that are being victimized just like everybody else in the community.
Representative Lush. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Holberg, one of the things that I kind of want to clarify is this is a separate section of law to enjoin specifically the gang activity. There's an entirely separate section under public nuisances that I think would probably cause a lot of concern to landlords because it provides for temporary closure of a property or that kind of injunctive relief. This does say that the judge can impose other kinds of injunctive relief, but this is the court order under 617.94 as proposed does not provide specifically for those remedies. It provides for the enjoining of the gang activity itself, and just corollarily does provide for a landowner as a defendant in the suit. It doesn't say, like a public nuisance statute, well, we're going to take your property, or you can't use it, you got to close it for you, that kind of thing as well. Now, because of it's injunctive relief, and a judge could get creative, I suppose there's a window for that, but it's not the intent of the bill.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Lesh, I have questions that actually address 2 separate matters. First is the constitutional concerns I have.
And then second, kind of goes to what Representative Holberg is identifying when you respond with, I can't imagine, and the intent and all that's well and fine. I think the intent of this bill is fantastic, but my question, and I see the first one on constitutional, I see you started to address it in the section 4, where you're talking about 2.13 to 2.16 on, you're trying to address, it appears, the First Amendment issues that would deal with freedom of association. In trying to get more information on this bill, I understand that it might be drafted, and you might have already said this today and I missed it, but it's drafted from similar language in another state, and question is, has it been challenged on constitutional grounds?
Representative Chair, Representative, yes, was challenged on constitutional grounds in California and passed in district court and on appeal.
It's on appeal, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Representative Emmer.
It succeeded on appeal, Representative Emmer. And it's, when was that? Within the last couple of years?
Representative Lush.
My boss can probably tell us, Mr. Chair. He knows everything.
Mr. Chairman, John Choi, St. Paul City Attorney, for the record. Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, the case that Representative Lush is referring to is the Acuna case, and the Supreme Court case was decided in 1997. And in that particular case, they upheld the use of a procedure very similar to House File 49. And I think what the court based their analysis specifically on was the fact that there was this process and procedure that was in place that would take, you know, the matter before a judge, and then you would have an evidentiary type of hearing, and that would all be contemplated in House File 49.
Mr. Chairman, November. Thank you, Mr. Choi. Question I have, and I think you've answered it somewhat, but I want some clarification, because this proposal, this House file in front of us, references Minnesota state statutes specifically from the criminal code in the definition section, and I assume that Minnesota's criminal code varies somewhat from California's criminal code. The you've said a similar process was upheld in California. They're not identical, is that correct?
They are not in California, but however, in Texas, it's very, very similar. In fact, this law was modeled after the Texas law. And in Texas, that the bill has been challenged and has never been overturned. There's been procedural issues that have kicked out the constitutional issues. But again, in Texas, this case, and this kind of follows the logic, is to make sure that when you have a law like this, that you set it up so that there is an evidentiary type of hearing that would be before a judge, and the judge would listen to that evidence and then would make a decision based upon all of the testimony.
All right. Mr. Chair,
Representative,
and that's good, because if you could address a couple things for me, because you guys practice in this area, specifically the criminal code. I don't. And I'm just going on the literal word. By the way, I think Texas still allows loaded shotguns and open bottles in their pickup trucks. But
Representative Emmer, if you weren't here, but we had a Representative Doug Ruder who lived in Texas while he was a representative here, and you may be inducing Representative Cornish to do likewise. Representative Emmer.
Here's the question I have. If you can look at your definition section, you reference the criminal gang has the meaning given to it in section 609.229. And when I pulled that up, it says that as used in this section, criminal gang means any ongoing organization, association, or group of three or more persons, whether formal or informal, that has as one of its primary activities the commission of one or more offenses listed in 609.11 subdivision 9, which I'll get to in a minute, has a common name or common identifying sign or symbol, and includes members who individually or collectively engage in or have engaged in a pattern of criminal activity. So I read that, then I turn over to 609.11, And I read that the applicable offenses, and I think you cite these in the proposed law, include assault in the first, second, or third degree. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Minnesota Wild and the Minnesota Vikings would actually fall within the purview.
Well,
you get some amusement out of it, Representative Lesh, but I think as I was reading it that they would fall within the purview of the language. And I think the intent is wonderful, but it seems to be a little broad. And there are a couple other things, as long as you're smiling, Representative Lesh. If you look under 60911, there's a couple of other crimes that I think would apply specifically to the Minnesota Vikings, but we'll leave those alone.
Representative Emmer and Representative Lesh, I think we can leave some of the Vikings activities in the criminal area
also, I think it's fans, been, Mr. Chairman?
I think it's been nationally publicized enough, some of their activities, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Emmer. Also, I would say one of the things that we're really looking at, I mean, you can't criminalize the flashing of a gang sign, but you can criminalize tagging of a building with criminal damage to property. You can criminalize, which we have, human trafficking, drug trafficking, those other kinds of activities, some of which are included under 60911 and some of which are not. So we have supplementary subdivisions that are laid out in subdivision 4 of the definitions. That we want it to be broad because criminal activity is very fluid. I mean, if you crack down hardcore on human trafficking, they're going to supplement their income with drug trafficking or guns trafficking, and we want that flexibility because as soon as we crack down on one thing, gangs will move to something else.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer. Thank you, Representative Lesh. And I look forward to getting a better understanding. But the reason I raise these is because my limited understanding is, and I'll read the California case and understand what the reasoning is, but this is exactly why these types of laws fail on a constitutional basis, is because there are some vague terms, and I know that has created successful court challenges to law. So I'm just pointing those out. I'm looking forward to learning more about it. Again, I think your intent is good.
Well, Representative Emmer, I had the same concerns when I was on this committee about 8 years ago when they were working on the definitions of gang activities. And it seemed to me that it took me a while to understand, but I believe that it is legitimate, and I think it's always been upheld. And I'm seeing from both of the two officer captain, and I'll call him Chief Strzok, they're nodding yes. I believe they've always been upheld, and they know better probably than most attorneys. Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, can you just talk to me a little bit? I guess I'm still confused about what including the property owners in this really gets us. What you're getting at here, I think, is really important. But I'm concerned about some of the issues Representative Holberg raised, some of the issues Representative Emmer raised. If we're really trying to stop gang activity, what does it get us if you've got a landlord, for example, who owns a fourplex in St. Paul or Minneapolis? Maybe lives in my district or Representative Holberg's district. I'm trying to understand what it gets us to get them involved. And what we're really trying to get at is the criminal activity, the gang activity. I'm especially concerned, as Representative Holberg indicated, about this issue of notice.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Coles, it comes down to responsibility. It is about responsibility. Now, responsible landlords are not going to have a problem with this at all. I mean, that's not going to be the case. Now, if we run into a case where there is a landlord, say, owns a fourplex, or even, I don't know, maybe a 12-plex or something, and there have been five incidents over the course of the past year of major crimes as delineated in 609-1111, and they seriously have no idea about any of them, I think that goes to a responsibility issue. That said, if we were to bring suit and say, hang on a second, or you're going to receive notice of a suit to enjoin gang members from being in here and disallowing you, what would this fundamentally do is disallow a landlord to rent to a person, because that would be
allowing them to continue in violation of a court order. You can no longer rent to this person. But if you come to a landlord, you say, did you seriously not know about these five events over the course of the past 12 months? And presumably there are a bunch of other incidents as well. I would be willing to guess that a landlord is going to say, wow, well, this person's out, because most criminal activity like that is a material breach of the lease anyway. Boom, you're out, and we wouldn't have the problem anymore. There'd be no reason to continue through and use city or county resources to bring suit. That would be what I would envision what would happen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cole. Representative Lesh, thank you. I agree there's a responsibility issue here, and I don't disagree with you at all, but I think I still have some of the concerns that Representative Holberg raised about the breadth of the language of the bill. Maybe it was Representative Emmer. I think that what you're getting at is critical. I think there's probably a way we can figure out how to do it, but let's not paint with such a broad brush that we potentially grab some people who aren't doing anything wrong, who really are victims to this bad activity themselves. And I guess one other question, Representative Lesh, if you could talk to me, help me understand the difference between what you're doing here and the existing public nuisance laws. You indicated there's already laws on the books that would allow for a rental house, for example, to be shut down for a year or more. Why do we need this as well? Help me understand that.
I would do this, first of all, Mr. Chair, and Representative Coles, to address the second part, I'll leave it to John Troy, city attorney for St. Paul, who knows a little bit more about the public nuisance statutes than me. But before that, with respect to this notice and knowledge situation, I'll tell you a story briefly about a situation in my neighborhood. With this house that was right next door, not right next door, but two down from my brother's house. And the landlords lived up in Roseville, and they got this house willed to them by grandma, who was in a nursing home, and they found themselves in the position of being landlords over a single family residence. Well, the woman that they rented to was a single mom with two kids. The eldest of her two kids was a real problem. He was involved in drug activity, and the neighbor in between my brother and this house had a huge problem. He was one of these guys that sat in his window all day and looked and saw what was going on, you know. So he's like, oh, your brother's state representative. Well, I'll call him. So I got the calls every time he was sitting next to his flower pot by the window. And so I called the landlords. I said, here's the deal. You know, you're running into some problems there. There's activity arguably going on that's in violation of law. Can you find a way to solve it? Because, like I said, a landlord has a much more ability to solve this problem than does the city. The city has to do all kinds of investigation. Well, the landlords got really upset. This isn't our fault. She's a single mom. She's just trying to raise her kids. Well, after the kid got arrested for the third time in this incident, they finally decided, well, okay, maybe this is a little bit too much. But they still were hostile because of how the relationship started out, from neighbor that sits in his window and probably called up and yelled at her. I would envision that in a situation like that, the problem is taken care of well in advance, and we're not going to bring suit under this situation.
Mr. Choi, did you want to answer?
To Representative Coles' question, Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, I think the primary difference between House Law 49 and 617-80, which is the public nuisance statute, is that under 617-80, it relates to a building. If you look specifically at 617 point, I believe it's 8-1 or 8-2, where it defines what acts constitute a nuisance, they list those factors like prostitution, gambling, drugs, illegal firearms. But those instances have to be limited to within a building. So what this does is, the difference here is that this relates to criminal gang activity, which is not included under 617-80, and allows for a broader definition. It's not limited, so to speak, to the building. It's the definition of to a place. So I would say, to answer your question, that would be the primary difference. And I guess we're making a different provision related to public nuisance. I mean, by this bill, you're declaring at the legislature that criminal gang activity as defined by Section 2 is in fact a public nuisance. Mr. Chair, one last question. Mr. Troy raised an issue. I hadn't even thought of this, but how are we defining a place? That, I guess that's a concern for me as well. A place could be a square city block. It could be a building. It could be the parking lot of the mini mart.
And I think that's a very critical
Mr. Troy.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Coles, because it may not just be a fourplex. It could actually be Sergeant Sraka was just telling me about a situation where we've got a problem between two bus stops between on 5th and 6th on Minnesota Street, and you've got a group of individuals who are kind of going back and forth right in front of a building. So it could encompass that particular situation where we may say that habitual use of that particular place. I'm not sure who necessarily would control. I mean, it's a sidewalk, and then there's a kind of an entryway to the building. But that's kind of what we're, that could all, this could also encompass that particular situation as well.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Choi, just for the record, I'd be just a little bit careful when you equate this proposal as being a statement that we are against criminal gang activity. We all believe in the intent. It's not something that some people believe in more than others, but you've also got or disorderly conduct under section 609.72 in here, which is defined as whoever does any one of the following in a public or private place, knowing that it will tend to alarm, anger, or disturb others, is guilty of disorderly conduct, and it includes engages in offensive, obscene, abusive, boisterous, or noisy conduct, or in offensive, obscene, or abusive language tending to reasonably arouse alarm, anger, or resentment in others. I would only suggest, maybe I've missed it, but this is what I was getting at. This would be the Viking fans wearing all their jerseys, screaming and yelling.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond.
Mr. Choi.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, I think in order to, what I was saying, you're defining as a public nuisance if you meet the criteria of Section 2. So as an example, if you look at Section 2, Subdivision 1, gang activities, you first have to prove a criminal gang, and that goes back to the definition of 609.229. You have to prove that it's continuously and regularly as defined above. And then you have to prove that, in fact, these are actually gang activities. The one instance that you describe, we are saying that could be a gang activity. What I'm saying is that when you have the combination of those three things, and you have it five times over a course of a 12-month period, the legislature, by this bill, is defining that to be a public nuisance.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Choi, and that's why I cited those other statutes, because by the letter of the statutes that you've cited, it would be criminal gang activity. This behavior, and I think they have 8 games a year at the Metrodome, I'm not trying to parse it apart. I think we need to talk about it, because what you're trying to accomplish, I think you're at risk of it's too vague.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Emmer, I would just restate what Mr. Choi just stated as a flowchart of proof standards, that you've got a bunch of hoops that you have to jump through to establish that. And remember also, the idea is that this goes before a trier of fact. I mean, this is not, if you meet all these things, boom, we put it all in a computer and it comes out, you know, guilty, boom, you get the injunction. No, this goes before a trier of fact to determine whether or not an injunction should be granted. And I can tell you as a prosecutor, most of the stuff around here I could charge as disorderly conduct, you know, and it pass statutory muster, but it ain't ever going to pass a trier of fact or a jury, ever. So I think there are enough protections in place.
I think that's an important point, that this is injunctive, and if you've ever been in court going for injunctions, it's not the easiest thing in the world to get. This bill will then be laid over for possible inclusion, and if we get a fiscal note back, we will then send that to the committee. In the meantime, before it comes up, if anybody still has questions, I hope you'll work with Representative Lifeline working out the things. We're adjourned.